We got to talk about the FBI. Like when you were with the FBI and being like their international lead kidnapping negotiator, undoubtedly an interesting time in your life. If you'd be open to it, you know, can you talk about one of the most perhaps challenging negotiations you ever experienced? Because this is interesting in the sense that, you know, without a doubt, you know, people now know you as the negotiation expert. But I imagine you've honed those skills through very, very challenging negotiations over time.
Well, one of the biggest ones, and we talk about it in the book, the Bernard Sobrero case in the Philippines. Now, we just come off of a kidnapping that went beautifully in that the hostage walked away. I mean, what we did was the great thing in negotiation is to create opportunities for good things to happen. You're not stalling for time, you're adding time. You know, create things, the opportunity for good things. In this particular instance, the bad guys, we warm out with the application of empathy, enough so that the hostage had the opportunity to simply walk away. No money was exchanged. And the bad guys weren't mad when it was all done. The lead negotiator for the kidnappers actually called the guy that I was coaching on the phone to congratulate him and basically pay his respects, not in an angry way. So we got another case with a different faction of the same group. They've switched everything out. They kill an American within the first week and a half. And they kill a bunch of people. I mean, they took over a dive resort. They killed people at the dive resort. They took a bunch of hostages. They sailed across the open ocean, 400 miles of ocean. They chopped off some more heads. There were some vicious guys. And then the thing ended about 13 months later in a botched rescue attempt by the Philippine military where the two out of three remaining hostages were killed by friendly fire. I mean, it was just end to end. It was a train wreck. What I really learned in that, though, was the negotiator that was the counterpart, he negotiated with us in good faith, and his team wasn't aligned behind him. You know, our philosophy that there's always a team on the other side. You can have a great relationship with your counterpart. You can genuinely read that your counterpart is being honest with you because as far as your counterpart knows, he or she really is. If you haven't taken into account the team behind them and found a way to involve them, then your counterpart is going to have the limb sawed off behind them. It turns out that happens in the private sector about half the time. Well, there's a telecommunications company that we were talking with involved in discussions to train them in negotiations. And we found out that fully 50% of the deals that they sign, not just that they negotiate, but 50% of the deals they actually sign are never implemented. What does that mean? It means that the point of contact was out of touch with his own team, and he got the limb sawed off behind him. I once had a salesperson refer to this as being single-threaded. This happened to us in the Philippines, and it caught us so off guard because we assessed our counterpart as to having legitimately made a deal, and our counterpart, when his side failed to back him up, he was actually genuinely humiliated. He was embarrassed. You know, when he did all the things that somebody does when they're really embarrassed at the position that they're left in. So that taught me to take into account the team on the other side and how do we adjust accordingly.
So on that note, what are some ways to adjust accordingly? Because I imagine this happens. I mean, this does happen all the time. You let's say you're in a sales negotiation. The person you're speaking to sounds great. Let me run it by my team. We'll send it back over tonight. And then things
go
away. What happened, right? It's almost like that another negotiation had to take place that we weren't a part of.
Right. Right. Well, so then the secret to gaining the upper hand that a negotiation is giving the other side the illusion of control. First of all, you got to get your counterpart comfortable. You got to give them the illusion of control. That's principally going to come through how and what questions. How and what questions are very deferential. It's not that you got an answer. It's the effect you had when you asked. So the effect you want to have when you ask is like, how does everybody on your side feel about this? You know, how do the people that have to implement this, how do they see this? Now your counterpart's going to be, they're fine. Everything's good. But the point was you asked the question which plants a seed in their mind. And then they're going to think twice about it. And you need to ask those questions a couple of times. Enough so that this person starts to think to themselves, you know, maybe I better double check. because they think it's their idea. There's a little inception going on here. Remember that Leonardo DiCaprio movie, trying to plant a seed. You're trying to plant a seed in their mind that the rest of their team is important. They have no idea that that's what you're doing. You're doing it deferentially, innocuously. As soon as they start going back to the people on their team, those people start to get looped in. You now begin to deal with your implementation issues. You're less likely to get single threaded.
So I don't even use to, when you talk about this, you talk about like a mindset of discovery when you go into negotiations.
Right.
What do you mean by that? Is it really just trying to understand how are decisions made? You know, who's involved? Just try to gain clarity on the situation?
Well, a couple of different things. First of all, the mindset of discovery is actually, it's a hack for you. It's basically a positive frame of mind, and it's curious. And you can actually take in more information. You see things faster when you're in that mindset. You pull in more data. Your pattern recognition increases. All the things that go to higher mental performance. So first of all, if you have a mindset of discovery, you're going to be smarter. You could easily argue probably at least 31% smarter, which is enough of an edge that if you're interested in edges, you're going to want it. Then the other thing too is, by definition, it's an asymmetric world. It's an imperfect world. We know we don't have all the information, yet we act like we do. You know, there's never a negotiation where you're not holding stuff close hold, holding stuff to the vest. There's never a time when you don't have cards that you're holding back. Well, if you're not doing that, then that means they got the same dynamic. So we intellectually know there's stuff that we don't know. Now, the crazy thing to really bend your mind around is what happens in the overlap. Because not only, since I don't know what they don't know, you know, the Donald Rumsfeld line, the unknown unknowns, but what's really sweet is when you hit the overlap. And between the two of you, you discover stuff that if you're holding it back, it's important, which means you're going to get an exponential effect if you can uncover it.
Now, I imagine there's people that, you know, are there people that can't be negotiated or reasoned with?
It's not that they can't be reasoned with. It's a little bit of what journey are they on to begin with? How scared are they? What's really the goal? Like in kidnapping negotiations, we had to recognize early on whether or not the goal was to actually kill the hostage. You know, the other side's on a killing journey. They want you to be part of that. The best you could do is get out of the journey. If the best thing you could do is to disrupt, then you simply withdraw.
So that's something like asocial violence, essentially.
Right.
So somebody walks into a movie theater, starts shooting up everyone. That's not a person interested in having a negotiation.
Right. Right, or they're orchestrating a different outcome. Right. So in a business world, you don't really get that, but what you get is you get people that are so scared of the environment. And this has happened in the healthcare space a lot these days. They're so scared of making any deal, they'll come to the table and all they do is call names. All they are is insulting. You know, there's overwhelmingly fear-driven. Now, you can get people out of that, but you got to recognize it that's what's driving them, and then you got to find a way to really gently help them see that what they're doing is actually counterproductive to where they say they're trying to go.
Okay, so listening to understand is what we're getting at here, okay? Listening is the most powerful tool in your toolbox. People don't realize that, but you don't get information if you're talking. So by itself, just listening to the other side can be persuasive, because some people will go all day long, especially if they're at work, and nobody listens to a thing that they say. So when you're in the negotiation with your counterpart and you're actually listening to what they have to say and you're labeling them and you're mirroring them and you're encouraging them to give you all kinds of information, they're feeling understood. Because in a negotiation, when you're trying to use tactical empathy, you should be seeking to understand the other side before you expect them to understand you. That's the whole big thing about it. You're showing deference to the other side. The other side is the most important. It's not about you. Nothing is about you. And you don't look for common ground, okay? We're not big pushers of common ground. It's not going to matter if your son and their son both play t-ball together. It's not going to get you to an agreement faster. It's going to be like a little, just a, oh, you, your son plays t-ball. My son plays t-ball. That's not going to make them like you any better, honestly. Yeah, you have something in common. Psh, doesn't matter. They have that in common with a million other people whose kids play t-ball. So common ground really isn't going to get you anywhere if there's not any kind of empathy behind it. So what we say is listen to what they have to say. Don't comment about yourself. The way I like to play it is I label and mirror someone and try to get as much information as possible from the other side, giving away as little as possible from me. That's just a tool that I use that helps me get to tactical empathy. Because it's very easy, even for those of us that have been using the skills for a long time and we're pretty well versed in this, it's very easy to get caught up in a conversation and all of a sudden a lot of your stuff is being insinuated into the conversation. And if you're having some kind of a negotiation with a counterpart, you don't want that, okay? You want information from them. That's how you find the black swans, encouraging the other side to talk. So you label, you mirror, you listen to what they say, which lets you get to a deeper label and a deeper mirror, or not a deeper mirror, a deeper label, which will potentially lead you to a black swan. That's how they get uncovered, okay? The more you label, you get more information from the other side, that's when those unknown things are gonna come out that will change the whole scope of the negotiation. You can't get that information if you're the one doing all the talking, okay? You have to basically give the other side the chance to give you that information. Okay, so listening is how you do that.
Never be mean to someone who could hurt you by doing nothing. That probably includes just about everybody. So be nice to everybody today. See how far that'll get you. Have an awesome day. The most dangerous negotiation is the one you don't know you're in. I met the guy who started the website Post Secrets, and it was about sending in your secrets anonymously. He got a message, including a brand new Starbucks coffee cup, which proved that the guy worked at Starbucks. And the note said, "I give decaf to people who are mean to me." The most dangerous negotiation is the one you don't know you're in. For those of you that think you might be developing a tolerance for caffeine, well, be nice to people today. Be likable. You're 6 times more likely to make a deal with somebody you like. Be likable. It increases your deal-making ability. Plus, when you're likable, you're in a better frame of mind. You're more positive. You're 31% smarter. So be likable. You increase your deal-making ability. You make yourself smarter, and you have a better day. The last impression is the lasting impression. What's more important than the first impression? The last impression. You can get away with a mediocre first impression. You can't get away with a mediocre last impression. Make a positive impression at the end. Say something that's true. Express positive regard. Express positive hope for a great outcome. Whatever it has to be. The last impression is the lasting impression. It seeds the next conversations, and it's what leaves the lasting impression. Make it a good one.
Always sound like someone that they want to speak to. Now, what that sounds like from person to person is going to vary, right? We talked about a lot about that last time. And then a lot of what we're going to talk about today, get your barriers out of the way, right? If you got a chance, right? Another sports analogy. Let's say you're running track and there's literally hurdles on the track in front of you. If you have the opportunity to remove all the hurdles off the track before the race begins, a lot of us would probably choose to do so instead of making the race harder on ourselves by jumping those hurdles or trying to anyway, right? And in negotiation, it's not like in real life where all the hurdles are the same height and they're all fall over easily in case you tip them, right? In negotiation, the hurdles are of different sizes. And if you run into one, it might knock you down, right? And so if we got an opportunity to remove those hurdles out of the way before we get started, why wouldn't we take it? And so if we sound like somebody who's easy, who they want to talk to, who they want to talk to, and that's why I'll make the distinction. That's someone who's easy to talk to. How do we sound like someone that they want to talk to? There's a fine line between the two. And then how do we remove those hurdles out of the way? And some of, back to the cliches from the book, but some of this is very important for us staying out in front of those things. And the first thing about that is never be mean to someone that can hurt you by doing nothing, which the reality is pretty much every single person we ever interact with. They can all hurt us by doing nothing. And they're much more compelled to do so if we've been mean to them or they feel disrespected by us in any way. And then the other part of this, which I'm sure, you know, a lot of you already think, but you haven't necessarily heard us say, how would you speak to someone whose position or point of view you actually care about? And that's something I actually struggle with, because I'm that type of person. I like to give advice, you know, especially people that I care about, right? I want to give them advice. I want to tell them how to solve it. I get caught up in problem solving mode. And when I do that, I know that I'm actually ignoring their point of view or positioning, because I'm problem solving. I'm not actually listening at a deeper level. I'm trying to help them figure out how to solve it or how to help them see the solution, as opposed to just listening deeper. And those are two very different things. So again, keep those things in mind. It's much harder to get our barriers or our hurdles out of the way if we're not focused on how they're affected emotionally at a deeper level.
What does the smarter look like? So if all of this is about two lines of code, like so much of your book revolves around, once you understand how people are wired, once you understand what their religion is, once you understand their two lines of code, we become controllable, isn't the right word, but we become movable.
Influenceable, if that's a word.
So how do we begin to suss that out? So when you're sitting across the table, and I know that a lot of this deploys against business negotiations, but I want to keep it when lives are on the line. So ultra high stakes, literal life and death. What are you asking? What are you looking for? How much of, like, the fact that you guys have these teams and everybody's broken up, okay, you're looking for positive statements, you're looking for negative. Walk us through that. What's the setup? And then how are we going to tease out this information?
Well, the setup is, we're going to pull together a team, because there's so much in what's said and the way it's said, even more in the way it's said, that there's more information coming off a person, even if you can't see them. There's more information that you can keep up with if you're not trying to respond. And then, you know, you formulate a statement in your mind, and the amount of time that you're formulating a statement, you're not listening. So there's just more data there than one person can handle. So we built a team concept, and we had different people listen for different things. And the more we thought about it, like, how long did the conversation go? How much profanity, which is, you know, emotional adjectives. How many emotional adjectives were in there? Negative emotional adjectives. As the conversations get longer and there's fewer negative emotional adjectives, you're making progress. It's never a straight line, so it's going to go and come. So, you know, what's our pulse? What's our frequency? And then would people really start listening for the nuances? And you get five people together. I mean, if you want to listen for everything, you probably need at least five people keeping track of everything. And then the patterns start to emerge really fast. Or like in a Tractor Man siege in D.C. and
Tractor Man?
Yeah, Dwight Watson drove a tractor to the middle of Washington, D.C., in 2003, just before the beginning of the first Iraq war. And his family had been crushed by the tobacco industry settlement. They were no longer able to farm and sell enough tobacco. You know, I don't know, but this the tobacco industry settlement ended up crushing his family business. He tried to protest in D.C. a couple of times, got legal permits to protest. Nobody cared. You know, save the tobacco farmer. That ain't exactly a hashtag that's real popular.
Yeah.
And it's not their fault that that's how they grew up making a living, which was completely legal, acceptable, and nothing wrong. And then the world suddenly decides it's a bad thing. So he protests a couple years in a row. Nobody cares. So he rolls back into D.C. now with his tractor and his trailer and his 4x4 and claims he's got bombs, which gets everybody's attention.
As a way of doing
it. Yeah, you'll get somebody's attention. The work in the case, Park Police negotiators, we're backing them up, we're coaching them, we're doing all the analysis for them. You know, we're the team that we put up around them because we work a good team. And we get to the point where he's found a face-saving way to surrender. You know, he said, I was in the 82nd Airborne, the 82nd Airborne, parachutes behind enemy lines, and you're there for 72 hours with no backup, you can withdraw. So basically, he's agreed to come out after 72 hours. Now, the problem is, he's a volatile dude. And since we don't know for sure whether or not he's got explosives, in a fit of rage, if he goes the wrong direction, the sniper's got a green light on him. And we're thinking like, all right, we got to keep this guy from getting himself killed. Because when you're in a rage, you're going to do something stupid. And there's a very specific protocol where we suspect the explosives might be. And if he makes a move for the explosives, we cannot wait and find out if they're there. And so we're thinking like, we got to get this guy out of here in less than 72 hours because that's just too much for stable behavior. We cannot expect him to stay cool for 72 hours. So there's a disagreement in the negotiation cell as to when he said he's going to come out. And I look at the negotiators and I go, when's Dwight coming out? And they go like, yeah, he's coming out tomorrow. And I said, I don't think he is. I think we're still 36 hours away. You know, we're not 8 hours away. Well, we'll call him and ask him. And I'm like, hold it. Before we call him, in the event he's not coming out tomorrow morning, what are we going to say to get him to change his mind? Now, we've heard all this military stuff, all this hyper-masculine stuff. And buried in the military jargon and the hyper-masculine stuff, there are hints of his religion, which is Christianity. Just hints of it. Just hints. And Winnie Miller, a female negotiator on my team, sitting in the back of the room. And what do we say? And Winnie goes, tell him tomorrow's the dawn of the third day. Because, you know, in the Christian religion, Jesus crucified on Friday, he gets up on Sunday. That's 48 hours. Mm. That ain't 3 days. That's not 72. It's one day to Saturday. It's 2 days to Sunday. So we're thinking about this. And we're like, yeah, okay. Dawn of the third day. So we call him back on the phone. They go, Dwight, when are you coming out? You coming out tomorrow, right? And he goes, no, I'm not coming out tomorrow. And then the negotiator brilliantly, because delivery is as important as awards, she brilliantly says, Dwight, tomorrow's the dawn of the third day. There's this long silence on the other end of the line. He goes, I'll come out tomorrow. Now, she saved his life, because I promise you that 24 more hours, he'd have cracked and he'd have made some move where the sniper would have taken him out. And we did not want that to happen. By this point in time, we're talking to this, and this poor schmuck has just been crushed. He's tried to get the world's attention. We don't think he's got bombs, but we don't know he doesn't have bombs, and we can't take that chance. We got to get him out of there before he gets himself killed. And so that was kind of, you know, here's a guy doing something that looked really bad, but there were still, possibly to your point, what's inside somebody? You know, what are those kernels, those grains that are still in there that maybe we can uncover, that maybe we can reach in and reach. And we got them out. He came out, didn't nobody got hurt.
When you became a hostage negotiator, when was your first real job?
Yeah, it was a Chase Manhattan bank robbery. Yeah, with hostages, which, although it happens all, you know, in the movies all the time, you know, Bruce Willis, Samuel Jackson, Kevin Spacey, Eddie Murphy, they're negotiating the hostages out of banks in every movie about it. In real life, it's a really rare event. Like, it was a bank robbery with hostages in New York City, and there hadn't been a bank robbery with hostages in New York City for over 20 years. Now, people get taken hostage in bank robberies, but generally the bad guys are gone before the police show up, because they know if the police get the place surrounded, their chances of getting away are low. So they're going to be gone. But to trap bank robbers in a bank with hostages is really, really rare. And that happened about a year and a half after I got out of the negotiation training. And I was still volunteering on a suicide hotline. So my skills, you know, you fall to your highest level of preparation. I was ready to go when they put me on the phone, because I'd been, negotiation's a perishable skill, and I'd been working at it. My skill level was really high at the time.
Are you nervous when you get that phone call about that bank robbery?
No, I was ready to go. I mean, I was doing it because I wanted to get involved. I wasn't doing it to get the T-shirt. You know, I was doing it because I wanted to get involved. And as a matter of fact, like, I was never asked to go. A friend of mine had taught me, and having made a mistake previously, I'd learned the lesson of just show up. If something's going down, show up. I heard this advice from a government official not that long ago, and he said, run to trouble. Always run to trouble. There's a whole bunch of reasons for that, whether it's business or law enforcement. One of the nice things about running into trouble, running into, you know, figuratively, theoretically, running into the burning house, you don't get criticized as much. You know, you run the trouble. If you're running into a static situation or something that a bunch of people have been dealing with for a while and it's just been sitting there in deadlock, and whatever you do, people are going to criticize you. You know, because they failed and you're doing something different and they don't want to see you succeed. But if you're running at, you're running to chaos, you're running to trouble, you know, the criticism is much lower. Mm-hmm. You know, nobody's dealing with it. Somebody's got to do something. Decisions have to be made. It's a great strategy. Run the trouble. Mm-hmm. And I had come to like that a lot. So I'm sitting at my desk in New York. My buddy Charlie walks up and says, there's a bank robbery with hostages in Brooklyn. Let's go. I looked at a police detective colleague because I had an interview scheduled that morning. I said, can you cover the interview? He says, yeah, I got it. And we go to the bank and we show up. And a team forms, FBI and NYPD both show up because it's a bank. We know the PD negotiators really well. Our commander, Hugh McGowan, super sharp guy, knew what he was doing. He integrated the team. First negotiator on the phone was a PD detective. He points at me, says, you're the coach. We stood up the rest of the team around Joe, the original negotiator. Joe talks the situation into stalemate, which is not a bad thing because the threat level's not coming up. And Lieutenant McGowan looks at me and he says, okay, you're up. And they handed me the phone.
And what was your job at that point? What was the bank robber asking for, and what was your job, your objective?
Well, we didn't know it at the time. Like, the bank robbery was actually the classic great CEO negotiator. Like, the great CEO negotiator is going to act helpless at the table because he doesn't want you to force him into a commitment. You know, I found this out some years later when I was learning negotiation at Harvard. You know, they call it a business strategy, blame somebody who ain't in the room. So a great CEO negotiator is going to be like, look, man, I got a board of directors. Like, I got to be careful what I commit to here because this board of directors, I do the wrong thing. These guys are going to fire me. You know, they're going to throw me right out of this company. And if the guy does that, he's got all the power in the world. He don't care about his board of directors. He just doesn't want to get backed into a corner. So the bank robbery, we get on the phone with this guy, the guy who orchestrated the whole thing. And he's like, man, I'm scared of these guys in here. These other guys that I'm with, man, they are dangerous. Like, I'm scared of them. They might hurt me. So I got to be careful what I say to you. Oh, here they come now. And I got to hang up the phone. And he was making it all up. You know, initially, our initial assessment is this guy's an inadequate personality. He's scared to make a decision. Complete smokescreen on his part. So, we're in the negotiation for several hours, and we got the bank surrounded, and then the investigators on the outside. And this is a residential commercial area of Brooklyn, so there are cars everywhere. And they identify the owner of every vehicle on the outside and talk to them, except there's one van out there, and it belongs to this guy. And as it turns out, this guy is running a cash courier business that services this bank. And they can't find this guy. He is nowhere to be found. So they go to his address and they say, hey, do you know this guy? And will you come to the scene of the bank and listen to the voice? Because we're running the negotiations on speaker outside to the commanders. And the witness comes in and says, yeah, that's this guy's name happened to be Chris also. So they voice ID this guy, and he has never given us his name. This is another great technique. If we meet and I don't give you my name, it unsettles you. You don't feel you've connected with me. And this guy would not give us his name. So, you know, we got a voice ID on him. When the lieutenant says, you're up next, he says, I want you to confront this guy about his name as quick as you can. And we're not going to do a normal smooth handoff. You're just going to start talking. Normally, the protocol is if you hand off from one negotiator to another, the second guy comes on, he says, look, I've been here the whole time, and I've heard everything that's going on, and here's everything that I've heard. Because you don't need the other guy on the other side saying, like, where do I start with this guy? You know, have you been here listening? Do you have any idea what's going on? It's a smooth transition. But a lieutenant, his gut instinct is like, yeah, we're not going to do this. This guy's a manipulative guy, and in a really subtle way, we're going to start taking back control. And we're going to start by not doing a smooth transition. So I get on the phone. I'm talking to this guy. Now, this is a cagey dude. We shift with no intro. So what does he do in order to remind us that he's got hostages, but also not raise the threat level? Because he's got to genuinely be concerned that the snipers are going to put a red dot on his forehead, and the next thing that's going to happen is he's going to be at the pearly gates explaining his actions over the last 24 hours. He goes and gets a hostage and puts her on the phone. We've been here 5 hours. We had no confirmation of the condition of the hostages other than him saying, I'm taking care of the girls. Everything's fine. As a matter of fact, I got to hang up the phone because they're hungry and they want to get something to eat. All kinds of smoke screens. So I'm on the phone and I hear this female voice come on, go like, I'm okay, I'm okay. And I'm like, who's this? What's your name? I'm okay. And then that's the last I heard of her. He comes back on the phone, pretends like this didn't even happen. So I'm like, all right, this is a cagey dude. We're going to go forward. I'm going to find a way to hit him with his name, but do it gently. So I start talking about his van outside, which he knows is out there. He just doesn't know that we've identified it. And I said, you know, we got a van out here, and we found the owners of every van and spoken to them except one. And he goes, we have more than one van. Now, I got no idea what this guy is talking about. So I did what we refer to as a mirror. I just repeat the words. Because my brain is like, what is this guy talking about? So I go, you have more than one van? He goes, no, we only have one van. I go, you only have one van? And he goes, yeah, and you chased my driver away. I go, we chased your driver away? He says, yeah, when he saw the police, he cut and run. Now, this super control freak guy is now blurting stuff out as a result of my mirror, my technique that he did not mean to say. This ends up convicting his getaway driver who had gotten away, and we didn't even know there was a third guy.
How did that case end?
Everybody came out.
Why did the bank robber concede in the end? Did he get anything he wanted?
Well, how do you negotiate when you're not going to give him anything? You know, you help him see a different vision of the future is what it really boils down to. And what you really want them to see is a vision of future where they live. And then you're hoping the survival instinct kicks in. And when the second guy got on the phone with me, his principal concern was getting killed.
Right.
And his secondary concern was being handled roughly when he came out. Of course, he knew that they had beaten the women on the inside. And that may contribute to his being handled roughly when he came out. But he, number one, didn't want to get killed. And number two, my opening line was, look, when you come out, you'll be treated with dignity and respect. And I said that to him enough times that he decided it was going to be true. And he asked to meet me face to face out in front of the bank.
Was he treated with dignity and respect when he came out?
1,000%. You got to keep your promises because... And, you know, this was one of the things when I was teaching negotiation at Harvard. You know, my academic brothers and sisters up there were like, would you lie to get the guy out? And my answer was no. And they'd say like, yeah, but let's imagine that a terrorist has got a nuclear bomb in Boston. And you know that if you lie to him, he won't set the bomb off. So how do you answer that one? And my answer is, well, number one, the guy's probably testing me to see if I'll lie. So I got to watch out that it's not a trap. Number two, if he's not testing me, he's going to be a better liar than I am. And he's going to sniff it out. You can't lie to a liar. You just can't. They're too good at it. And then number three, even if I lied to him and get him out, somebody's going to find out that I lied, and I will always have the reputation of being a liar. And I can't risk my reputation.
How do you do it? As I said, you guys are involved in difficult conversations every single day. There's probably not a day that goes by that you're not telling somebody within your area of responsibility, no. There's probably not a day that goes by that you're not telling somebody something that they don't want to hear. And so how are you going to manage that the next time it happens? When you get off of this call, some of you probably have a conversation lined up just like that, where you're going to have to share with an employee, a direct report, something that's going to ruin their day. It can be something as significant as they're being terminated, or it could be something as mild as you're moving the water cooler from one side of the office to the other. I guarantee you somebody's going to have a problem with you moving the water cooler. So how do you get out in front of that? How do you soften the blow? How do you take the edge off of that? With the accusations audit, this is where you proactively address the negative emotions and dynamics as the other side sees. There is an irrefutable need for you to address negative emotions and dynamics in a proactive fashion. That is before they're ever spoken by your employee. What do you need them to do? You need them to execute on something. To execute, they're going to need to be cognitively nimble. You need to make them smarter. How do you make them smarter? By addressing the negative dynamics and emotions before they're spoken. I talked earlier about the amygdala. Anytime that you're in those conversations where I want or I need or in anybody's head, that amygdala is going to fire up. You need to clear out that junk. You need to clear out those negative emotions and dynamics so that they can just be smarter.
your brain works 31% better when you're in a positive frame of mind. So put them in a positive frame of mind. Negative emotions never go away. Negative dynamics never go away. Ignoring them is not a strategy. Pretending that they're not there is not a strategy. Trying to explain them away is not a strategy. Hang a label on them and get rid of them, because unexpressed emotions and feelings, dynamics never die. Those negative emotions and dynamics are the single biggest driver of human decision-making and behavior. Negative emotions, negative dynamics, the single biggest driver of decision-making and behavior. So we know from trial and error that labeling negative emotions diffuses them. So anytime you're in one of those difficult conversations and you're going to lower the boom on somebody, or you're going to announce change that's going to cause a problem with somebody, diffuse it by labeling it. Go into that conversation with a list of all the negative opinions, assumptions, and impressions that your employees may say, harbor, or think about you, about the company, and about the circumstance. Whether they are insane or sane, fair or unfair, it does not matter, because it's their perspective that we're more focused on, not our own. And so before you go into the, when you have time to prep, before you go into those difficult conversations, think to yourself, if I were them, what would I be thinking about me and this message, and what is their perception of the company? And when we say, I have all in red letters there for a reason. We will instruct you as coaches to go all in on these accusations audits, because if you do not, the ones that you fail to put on the list are the ones that are going to provide fuel for the pushback at the end, or is going to provide fuel for less than stellar performance when it comes to execution. Brandon, you're back online. Did you want to jump in at all?
I think that sounds good. I mean, the only thing I would emphasize is the going all the way in. I mean, it feels like, especially when you're not familiar with the accusations audit skill, for you personally executing, it can feel like you're throwing yourself under the bus. Or even for some people, it feels like you're conceding to the other person's point of view, and you're bending your own position in order to do so. That's what it feels like for you. The receiver, the person you're doing the accusations audit on, what it feels like to them is you have an in-depth understanding of what the world looks like to them, which instantly makes you more credible, it makes you easier to respect, and it makes it easier to collaborate with you and actually listen to what you have to say. You know, a lot of our survey results are, how do I get my people to listen better, right? People are not listening to what I have to say, and they're not executing because they didn't listen. A lot of that starts with being able to accurately describe their world, no matter how crazy and convoluted and weird it may seem. It doesn't change the fact that that's what their world looks like, right? If they're seeing cats and dogs falling out of the sky, and they're seeing disrespect and unfairness and not being given a fair shake, and, you know, the world has got their thumb on them and they've been dealt a bad hand, none of that might be true from your point of view. Again, it doesn't change what they think. And so going all the way in with the accusations audit, I can't emphasize that enough. So that's the only thing that I would add in there, Derek.
When you start to label something that they have not articulated yet, it's almost like you're living in their brain. And there is no better way to establish to your subordinate that you understand. It doesn't mean that you agree with. Doesn't mean that you like their position. Has nothing to do with that at all. It's just that you understand. Now, your inclination is going to be to compile this list, start throwing these accusations audits out, and then wanting to explain them away immediately. Don't do it. You're simply going to say, you know, I know this is going to put you in a bad spot. I know that you feel like we continue to pile on you. You probably think that we're just trying to be, trying to impose our will. And once you start to lay all of that out, you're not looking to explain why it's not the case. You're throwing it out and letting it sit, pausing a second or two between each one. The goal is to get them to cut you off, to tell you, no, I wasn't thinking that, or no, please, let's stop this. Let's go on. What's this all about? Either way, you're giving them, or they're giving you, permission to take the conversation in the direction that you ultimately want it to go, but it sounds like it's their idea to move the conversation forward. So, moral of the story, if you come up with 10, use all 10, because the ones that you don't use are the ones that they're going to kill you with at the end of the conversation, or kill you with when it comes to actually executing.
I'm going to throw the first question out there. Everybody's desperate in just asking this question, because I notice you have, this audience has a lot of discipline. Everybody is trying to practice negotiation on a regular basis. And the first challenge since the pandemic earlier this year is that people sort of lost touch with that daily practice. They really want to know, like, how I saw examples, how to negotiate at Starbucks, how to negotiate with a travel vendor or agency. But what's your advice right now in the pandemic that people can continue to hone in on their skills and practice their negotiation skills at home?
Well, you know, we use it with everybody we communicate with. We use it with each other. I mean, one of the questions that we all get a lot is, you know, what if you're up against a black swan trained negotiator? You know, and that's fine. I mean, you know, Brandon asks me all the time, is it a ridiculous idea? You know, are you against? Derek asks me all the time, I can't believe how stupid you are. Stuff like that. I mean, we're... Sorry, it's going to be one of those days. But yeah, I mean, what do you guys think? Am I crazy?
No, I think you're right on the money. I mean, every opportunity to communicate is an opportunity to practice. And, you know, as of late, one of the ways we've been directing people is, if you're still paying utilities, right, you got utility bills. Those are great people to call up and use your skills on and get your bills down, right? That's one perfect way to practice.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing is the foundation, where this stuff came from, the world of hostage and crisis negotiation. 95% of the jobs that we did were on the phone. We didn't have contact, physical contact with the people that we were dealing with. So the fact that people are out of their normal environments and they don't have that regular human to human contact should not diminish the opportunities that they have to practice the skills via Zoom calls or via regular phone calls. The environment has just changed slightly, but this is all of our stuff is predicated on hostage negotiation, and we were rarely ever face to face.
Yeah, I love that. Thank you for clarifying. So everybody who's watching, you know, start negotiating, start practicing right away. And, you know, there's one question I love, which came from Adam, which is, which are the skills that you teach, do people generally find most difficult to learn, and why?
You know, I'm actually kind of curious to hear what Derek has to say on this, because I got a couple of ideas. Derek, you know, what's your perspective?
I think you know where I'm going to go. I'm going to go with the accusations audit.
Yeah.
Hands down, the most effective skill that we have, the most potent, the most powerful, hands down, the most difficult to absorb and execute. Simply because when you talk about the black swan skills being counterintuitive and being awkward, the accusations audit is awkwardness on steroids. And because you're pointing a negative light back at yourself. And when you point a negative light at yourself, you're making yourself uncomfortable. And when you're uncomfortable, what you want more than anything else is to be comfortable again. So that's where we find a significant amount of the pushback is with the accusations audits, because it's hard to take that negative light and point it at yourself and saying, this is what you're probably thinking about me. And it's all negative stuff. And so getting people to overcome that discomfort and execute anyway is probably the biggest challenge.
Yeah. Good brand.
Yeah, there's nothing Derek said that I would disagree with. However, I'm going to give you the classic negotiator's answer as far as what's hardest to learn. It depends. And a lot of it just depends on the individual. And so if you're part of the group that has read the book and have started trying to execute on your own, the thing that really is like the sticking point is probably the accusations audit. Right? If you're a novice and you're just getting into it and you're just starting to learn, people really struggle with labels and really on the side of executing them at their highest degree. You know, like surface labels are pretty easy for people to wrap their mind around. Seems like price is important to you, right? But being able to construct a label that actually identifies the motivation behind how they got to this price point, that's a little bit more difficult. Labeling things that aren't actually said in the negotiation, you know, is tough. It's a hard thing. And it, again, just takes practice. But yeah, it depends. It depends on who they are or how much knowledge they have and what they deal with.
Yeah. Chris, do you want to add anything else?
Yeah, you know, I mean, there's so much on it depends, you know, situation drives strategy, like Brandon likes to say, where are you in your journey? Mm-hmm. Labels are one of the first things to get over the hump with. You get to labels and depend upon how comfortable you are with calling out negatives and then being proactive. And that leads right into the accusations audit, you know, the fear of that. I mean, probably the fear there is the biggest. That's the single biggest fear-based obstacle there. And simultaneously, if you're getting good at labels, making a jump from labels into summary is hard. Because, you know, we teach people really hard, you know, to go silent, to go dead silent. We used to call it effective pauses and never split the difference. Book we got coming out collaboratively, Brandon and I and a couple of other people are working on. In the spring, it'll be out late spring, early summer. We're changing effective pauses to dynamic silence. Mm-hmm. So, you know, getting people to go dead silent. Like some people feel like they're going to burst into flames before they could go dead silent. Well, then if we get you there, then we want to teach you summary, and summary is firing everything. Summary is just letting go with everything, and that's no dead silence at all. So it's kind of, where are you in your journey? And each step of the way is going to take you to a new level of the game. You know, it's like a game. And it's all fun. As soon as you embrace how much fun it could be, it's really cool.
Hmm. So funny. My friend Michael O'Brien, also part of my mastermind group, really likes Brendan's jacket, first of all. I think he looks exceptionally handsome today.
Thank you.
Oh, sorry, Chris. Take it easy. I agreed. Silence is the toughest thing for me to practice, as well as for Michael there. I remember going through an exercise as part of Alt MBA by Seth Godin. And I remember that before we respond to anything, we have to count to 5 seconds or 3 seconds. They felt like hours. It was very awkward, a lot of resistance. So how do you practice? Like, how do you give yourself that patience?
Oh, that's you, Brian.
Well, you know, it's a similar philosophy. You know, we talk about people counting Mississippis or counting 1,000s. But exactly to your point, Faye, I mean, it's creating an intentional void in the conversation is difficult to sit in. And that's really what it's designed to do. If you set up your dynamic silence properly, ideally it reveals a black swan at the same time. But that's exactly, that is very hard. And counting is one of the great mechanisms to kind of keep yourself in your chair.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very hard. I mean, I remember since the pandemic, like washing your hands while singing happy birthday, those 15, 20 seconds just feel so long.
Now let's dive in. Number one, is now a bad time to talk? Now we're going to give you several no-oriented questions in a row because they're awesome and they help get you an advantage right away. But one of the things I'm going to underscore on these no-oriented questions is the issue of decision fatigue. Now, look, everybody's got the same problem. We all suffer from decision fatigue. You suffer from decision fatigue. What does that mean? What that means is there are only so many decisions you can make in a given day. There are only so many decisions any human being can make in a given day. That's one of the reasons why if you're in prison and you come up for parole, you want to come up for parole in the morning instead of the afternoon, because in the afternoon, they're going to give you no decision. They're not going to be able to make a decision. You're more likely to stay in jail. This is not parole and parole board issues. This is human nature issues. There are only so many decisions, only so much gas anybody has in a tank to make decisions on a given day. And that's going to be a result of, you know, how much sleep they got the night before, what their diet is, what they ate that day, whether or not they ate carbs, where they are in their circadian rhythm. Everybody hits a circadian low roughly about 3 a.m. and about 3 p.m. Just part of being a human being. Decision fatigue issues. However, we found in a Black Swan group, through practice and application, that people are capable of saying no at pretty much any time of the day. I had an intern a number of years ago, only wanted to ask me how and what questions because he was horrified about making a mistake. Middle of the afternoon, he'd be asking me how and what questions, and I just didn't have the gas in the tank to answer him, to be able to engage in that deep thinking, as Danny Kahneman would say. So consequently, I'd say, like, I don't know, don't bother me, leave me alone, instead of giving him an answer. Finally, I said, look, don't ever ask me a question after 1 o'clock in the afternoon where the answer isn't no, because I could say no and I can think through the next several steps and give him guidance. We've used this on a regular basis. You got to get into practice using no-oriented questions. And number one is the flip side of the most common thing you're saying on a regular basis, which is wrong. Actually, it's not that it's wrong. It's just not great. Is, have you got a few minutes to talk? Now, I know you mean that respectfully. And we're not throwing respect out the window here. The Black Swan method is actually extremely respectful. Is now a bad time to talk? Test drive it, use it on a regular basis, build your no-oriented questions, mental synapses, and experiment with the sort of answers that you get. You're gonna like them. And as a side note, I would say to you, anybody that would say yes to that, do you really want to talk to them? Then, at that moment, when they've actually said yes to that, no, you don't. All right, number two, is it a ridiculous idea? Use this in place of, is it a good idea? For all the same reasons that I just gave you. You got to get your practice in. Number three, are you against XYZ, whatever it may be? Instead of, are you in favor of? Again, you've got to use this to get into practice. We had a woman at in a hospital services company once who was a little skeptical of our no-oriented questions approach, walked out of the room during the training and reached out to the head nurse in a hospital about a program that she'd been trying to get the head nurse to accept that the head nurse had been rejecting. Instead of saying, do you want to agree or would you like to do this? She said, are you against? And then asked the question. The head nurse immediately said no. They came to an agreement and they implemented the program. She came walking back in the room and said, you guys are not going to believe what just happened. I've been trying to get agreement on this for weeks and I switched from a yes question to a no question and cut the deal. Got to get your reps in. Number four, have you given up on X, whatever that X may be? This is context driven. What's the context? It has to be something they've already started on. Otherwise, you're using a Black Swan skill as a manipulative trap, which is not what we advise. They have to have already started on this. Now, when do you use this? You use this when they are ghosting you. They've gone silent on you. This will restart your conversation 999 times out of 1,000. Don't let the fact that it stops 1 in 1,000 times stop you, scare you. Nothing works all the time. This works more than anything else does. And what makes it work? Well, you got to keep this in mind. Your system is perfectly designed to give you the outcome you've obtained. If they've gone silent on you, you've been doing something to contribute to them going silent on you. You've probably been explaining. You've probably been pitching. You've probably been educating. Got to stop all these things. Restart the conversation with this one shot restart. And then your very next move is you got to get a TR out of them. What's a TR? That's right. How do you get a TR? How do you get a that's right? You got to summarize their perspective, particularly their reservations, their reasons for not doing it, what they're up against, the difficulty of what they might be facing, and then go dead silent. You do not go, but here's why those aren't good reasons. You got to go dead silent and get a that's right out of them. If you can't get a that's right out of them at that point, you've got to say, it sounds like I've left something out. That's a bonus response for you to use here, which is not on our top 10 list, but helps you get farther in your conversations. Number 5, and we're going to get into the category here with letting out no a little at a time. A person that I consider a good friend and I'm really impressed with, Ned Colletti, former GM of the Los Angeles Dodgers. We were sitting around talking about negotiation one time. Ned is a phenomenal negotiator, and he told me the phrase, I like to let out no a little at a time. This is a great attitude. You do not want to let people get blindsided by you suddenly saying no. You've got to let it out a little at a time. And the first way of letting out no a little at a time in a highly collaborative way is, how am I supposed to do that? Now, many of you know this is one of the most famous lines with the Black Swan Method, and it's pretty much the opening story in the book Never Split the Difference. How am I supposed to do that? And we originally conceived of this as a way to passively say no, even passively aggressively, against the throat-cutting negotiators that are really trying to kick your backside. And what it is in many other ways is, it's an implementation question. How questions are about implementation. It's designed to let the other side realize that there's some implementation issues here. This also falls in the category of what Brandon Voss has labeled forced empathy. It forces the other side to take a good empathic look at your situation. We use empathy because it works, and we use empathy because we want to get it in return. You're going to use empathy because it works, and you're going to use empathy because you want it in return. And how am I supposed to do that is a great starting point for that. Now, what happens if they turn around and say, well, that's your problem? Will they put it right back on you? Which will happen occasionally. Once had a woman say, I used how am I supposed to do that, and it didn't work because they shot back right at me and told me how I was supposed to do that. Well, number one, the fact is it's not that it didn't work. The fact is that it's giving you a better, clearer picture of the situation. They throw it right back on you. They're telling you they're not interested in showing you any empathy. That's an interesting clue that maybe you don't want to do business with them. All right, I'm going to give you 2 ways to subscribe to the Black Swan Group's negotiation newsletter, which is free. Doesn't cost you anything. I had a colleague with the FBI that used to like to say, if it's free, I'll take 3. Here's how you subscribe to The Edge if you're in the United States. If you're not, I'll give you a method right afterwards. Send a text to, the number is 33777, that's 33777. The text message that you send is Black Swan Method to 33777. It's concise, it's actionable. That's the most important parts of this, concise and actionable. Comes to your email inbox on Tuesday mornings when you're ready to rock and roll and get after the week. Now, if you're not inside the United States, you see the Black Swan website, the homepage. You go up on the right-hand side here on this menu here, you see blog, click on that. Bang, you're at the negotiation edge. On the right-hand side right here, subscribe. First name and email, sign up now. There's a ton of free information on this site, on the Black Swan Group website, home. Look at it, get everything free that we have. If it's free, you should take three. And in the model of letting out no a little at a time, here's the next no that you let out, which is number six on our list. And it is, your offer is very generous. I'm afraid that just doesn't work for me. Now, here's the beauty aspects of this. You mentioned generous. You want to encourage generosity on their part. That's a good thing for you to throw into this statement. Second part, it just doesn't work for me. That removes the problem of external criteria. Now, my academic brothers and sisters like to talk about, well, let's agree on an external criteria. Why should you agree to the external criteria? Maybe the external criteria is okay and appropriate in a neutral situation or in situations other than yours. Well, why should external criteria apply to you? In many cases, it doesn't. You want to remove an agreement on external criteria from the conversation because they're only going to agree to external criteria that works against you, and you don't want to put yourself in that corner. This is a great way to come back with a much stronger no. One of the students in our class at Georgetown said they use that phrase, your offer is very generous, but I'm sorry, it just doesn't work for us. And he said the people on the other side of the table looked at each other and then looked back at him and said, you're right, it is high. Now, that's an interesting response because you want to have an impact on what you say. What you say and what they hear. You want them to get across in their brain. If stuff doesn't work, there's a pretty good chance it's too high. You don't want them to feel backed into a corner when you're letting out no a little at a time. And this is a great way to do that. Don't back people into a corner. They will disagree even when it's not in their interest to disagree. Taking away their autonomy is a bad idea, and that's what happens when you back people into a corner. Now, number seven. This is another counterintuitive response, and you use it for when somebody calls you and says, how are you today? Instead of saying, fine, you know, how are you? Or my back hurts, or it's a wonderful day. When they're calling you and saying, how are you today? What are they really trying to find out? Well, they're really trying to find out, are you in a mental place to talk about what I want to talk about? So here's how you short circuit this conversation in a way that builds rapport, that they appreciate, gathers information, and preserves your most precious commodity and theirs, which is time. It sounds like you've got a place you want to start. They are going to love this. Of course they have a place they want to start. They've thought about it before they called you. Now, every now and then, somebody's going to say to you, yeah, I do have a place I want to start, but I really want to know how are you today. Cool. Then engage in the conversation. And then you can get back to the place they wanted to start. Everybody wins. Number eight, another counterintuitive response. And this is how you should respond to questions when you're asked a question. So the first way to respond to questions, and number eight on our list, is what makes you ask? Just like that. Now, when somebody asks you a question, what's more important is the question behind the question. What makes you ask? For two reasons. Number one, most people are not good at asking questions. That question may be a result of a committee decision. You know how good a committee is? Well, let me give you an example. A giraffe is a horse designed by a committee. So committee decision questions are going to be off. On number two, what's really driving at what make them ask is far more important than what they actually asked. So you got to find out, and this is not disrespectful. They're going to be happy to tell you. And if they're not, well, that tells you a lot about them too. And how can you respond if they say, just answer the question? Your response is, I want to make sure that I answer what you're really asking me. I'm just trying to dial in to what you're really after. More respect. If they don't like respect from you, that tells you a lot about them and whether or not you should continue to be in business with them. Now, what happens if it's the middle of the afternoon, they're decision fatigued, they're having trouble coming up with an answer, it's too in-depth? The alternate to great calibrated questions and what makes you ask is a calibrated question. You want to ask an alternative label, an asking label, if you will. And so number nine on our list is the alternative to what makes you ask. And that is, it seems like you have a good reason for asking that. Or it seems like you have a good reason for asking that. I gave you both inflections there. Make sure you shut the front door right after you use that label. What does that mean? Go silent. Count thousands to yourself if you have to. Let them break the silence. You won't get past three. Be prepared to count to 10. And wait. Respectfully. This is a respectful dynamic. And respect is one of your best choices. Finally, number 10. On the top 10 list of black swan negotiation bullets. You're going to use this when the other side is failing to perform. When they're not living up to an agreement. What do you say? It seems like you have a reason for not doing. And then whatever it is that they didn't do. X, Y, perform. Finish the contract, finish the work, call me back. They're going to have a reason. They're probably afraid to tell you. This is the best way to re-engage a collaborative approach to whatever the problem is so that they feel safe and respected. Always the keys to a long-term relationship.